Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
As you get ready to expand your knowledge this offseason, make sure to save the date for USA Football's 2020 National Conference taking place February 21st through the 23rd in Louisville, Kentucky. This is more than just a clinic. It's your chance to hone your ability to teach proven and effective techniques while connecting with coaches across the country. Most coaches are satisfied if their regional clinic delivers just one or two nuggets of information. National Conference delivers a one-of-a-kind, high school-focused, live field experience that will give you an abundance of drills and techniques to improve your team's performance. Coaches can deep dive into both X's and O's and technique at classroom and chalk talk sessions. Finally, USA Football delivers top keynote speakers year after year. Here's a few of the keynotes from previous years: Mike Tomlin, John Gruden, PJ Fleck, and Jeremy Pruitt. As an added bonus this year, paying attendees can get access to the advanced tackling system and contact system for blocking and defeating blocks following the event, and have a chance to earn the new advanced contact certification. If you're ready to get to work on next season, don't miss out on USA Football's National Conference. Learn more at nationalconference.usafootball.com/podcast. Enter the code PODCAST179 to save at registration. On today's podcast, we revisit our conversations with special teams coaches. We cover everything from philosophy, personnel placement, technique, and schemes of the different units with some of the best in the game at all levels of football. First up is Scott Fountain, the special teams coordinator at Georgia. He shares his thoughts on which type of players coach looks for to play special teams and how he decides how many units each player is competing on.
Yeah, I think a couple of things, and it's different everywhere. And a lot of times it goes back to the head coach. But here, every kid is going to play on special teams. They don't really have a choice here. And that's just something that comes from our head coach. He promotes it from day one. If you play on teams, then you can play on offense and defense. So that's our approach to it. Now, you do have some positions, like a quarterback, that obviously is not going to play on special teams. But, you know, so how I try to break it down is, hey, if a guy's a starter for us, I typically will try to start him on two units. And if a guy is starts for us and has great endurance, such as Miko Hardman that played here last year, I will start him on three teams. So, like, Miko last year was our punt returner, kick returner, and he also was our gunner on punt, which that's rare to have a guy that can do all three and start. But that's one of the avenues. The next avenue is we look for guys that have a smaller role on offense or defense. You know, they might be playing 10 or 15 snaps a game, and try to get them into four roles on special teams. So those are guys that are going to have a bigger role on teams and a little bit smaller role on O and D. And then probably the last one that's probably the most important is I try to find a guy or two or three that maybe doesn't play at all on offense or defense, but he has a knack for special teams. And, you know, Brandon King's a guy that I coached at Auburn. He's been with the Patriots now going his fifth season. I didn't play at Auburn, but he was great on teams. And so I always try to sell that to guys that, you know, if you can just find an opportunity to play and help us on teams, you have an opportunity for a great career at the next level. And we had a kid here last year named Jason Stanley. He's now with the Falcons. Same situation with him. Played on offense, but started on all of our teams. So we look for those guys that have a big role in O&D and try to involve them with at least one. We try to get them on two teams. And then guys that have a less role in O&D, get them a much bigger role on teams. And then our guys that may not play at all, just has a knack for playing teams, you know. So we try to break it in those three categories and then try to build our special teams around that.
Eric Link is the special teams coordinator at Appalachian State. They were one of the best in the FBS on special teams in 2019. He discusses the culture of App State special teams units and how he uses what he calls E3 to define them.
Well, I think first and foremost, when we talk about special teams, we're talking, you know, how can we make them special? How can we, you know, separate ourselves? Like you said, so when you cut the film on Sunday morning or you're watching as a spectator, on television? What are you going to see? And for me, I call it the E3. The first, you know, is energy. We want to be the most excited football team on the field. So whether we're going on the field for a kickoff, whether we're going on the field to punt the ball, whether punt return, whatever phase it is, we want to make sure that we're the most excited team on the field during that time. The second thing is effort, you know, and it's fanatical. We want to have fanatical effort in everything that we're doing. And at the end of the day, it's what you control. No matter how talented we are, we can always control the effort that we put forth. And so that's a critical component. And then the third part of E3 is execution. And kind of what I talk about with that is we want to have a sniper mentality. Special teams are different from offense and defense because we don't get a series. We don't get a series of plays. You don't get three, you know, plays. You get one chance to make your opportunity. And so we want to have a sniper's mentality, and a sniper gets one chance to do their job, and we want to have that same mentality, whether it's our kicker kicking a field goal, whether it's our, you know, R3 running down on kickoff, whatever the case may be, we have to execute at a high level and do our job. And you're out there for one play at a time, and you either get the job done or you don't. And so when we talk about our special teams mentality, and kind of how we're going to make it special, it comes down to E3 for us. It comes down to our energy. It comes down to our effort, and it comes down to the level of execution that we're going to take part in. And then really the other thing I think you're going to see, Keith, is you're going to see a special teams unit that's very simple schematically, that allows the players to play fast, but is going to be diverse with how we present that scheme. You know, whether that's from, you know, on the punts, from the punt standpoint, formationally, motions, how we're going to, you know, try to put stress on the return units. And, you know, or that's, you know, from a punt return standpoint, are we going to come after you? Are we going to overload you? Are we going to max return you? Are we going to get double teams? You know, how is that going to look? So we want to be simple schematically, so our guys are playing fast, but try to present it in a diverse way. And then to me, this is probably the key thing, is personnel, you know, putting our players in positions to be successful and identifying again what they do well and what they don't do well, and making sure that we're plugging them in, you know, in places where they can do ultimately what we're asking them to do. So, again, it's E3, it's being simple, and it's putting your personnel in the right spots.
Shane Fogarty is the special teams and running backs coach at Fordham University. Coach talks about his punt return philosophy and what kind of players he looks for when building out his special teams units, as well as his HIT acronym, which stands for Heart, Intelligence, and Technique, and why having heart is the most important part of it. Let's take a listen.
We're actually solely a return unit. We, early in my special teams career, I spent a lot of wasted time going four blocks and then getting into game scenarios and situations and just not having those called. And it turned out to be a waste of a lot of practice time and install time. So, you know, we have blocks. We will install blocks that are uniform so that we can cover our bases. But we are primarily a return-based team. And the simplification of our units, specifically this season, have allowed us to be more successful in both punt return and kick return.
Well, it all comes down to execution. You know, you can do a lot of unique things on special teams, but, you know, you have to be efficient with your practice time, obviously, to have the execution you want on game day. So, you know, with that in mind, let's take a step back and let's talk about the people and, you know, whether it's your punt return unit, punt, et cetera. How do you start to identify these are some guys who have skill sets that we probably want to use on special teams? What kind of things do you look for?
I mean, ultimately, you're looking for bigger, faster, stronger. You know, across the board, those are the guys that potentially start, you know, on your units with your list. But to be honest, I think, and like I said, in our our acronym that we use is HIT, Heart, Intelligence, Technique. And I, the head coach, Coach Briner, has really allowed me to do a lot of things on special teams. And one of those things is to set the depth chart. And I challenge the assistant coaches, because all of our assistant coaches are involved in special teams. I allow them veto power over me in terms of who they want to coach and who they think can get the job done. So we'll have depth chart conversations about any player on our team if the coach tells me, yeah, I can get him to do the job necessary. But the first criteria is heart. Having a kid run down on kickoff that doesn't want to do it or doesn't have the confidence in doing it, I have found that is not going to be successful in doing it. They may be the fastest kid. They may be the strongest kid. They may be the kid that, you know, makes a lot of plays on offense or defense. But if he's not willing to run down on kickoff and he's not paying attention, and he's not reading his keys and doing what he's coached to do, ultimately, he's not going to make the play. So in terms of the players that we're looking for, is I'm looking for guys that it's important to. You know, our punt return unit did not have two starters on it. And the rest of the individuals on the unit were all backups. And they took great pride in being on that unit. And they would practice it. They would practice the technique. They would make jokes about it. You know, they bought into what we were teaching. And that ended up being statistically one of our best units on the year, because there were a group of guys that wanted to be on the unit. They were given opportunities. They worked hard in practice, even though, you know, as you get into the season, we'll do a little bit of individual, but, you know, a lot of it is scheme-wise. And because we're simple, we can do a little more individual, but still you're trying to get full field reps. And, you know, they bought into it. So I think the thing that I'm looking for in establishing the depth chart is of course you want the kids that are bigger, faster, stronger, but I'm really trying to find the kids that take great pride in being out there. You know, on your punt unit, you've got to have the most trustworthy kid. That's what I'm looking for. And ultimately, Coach Briner will ask, hey, do you trust this guy to be on the unit? It's a simple yes or no. Either you trust him to get his job done, or you don't. He may not be the fastest guy. He may have limitations, but if I can trust him to block who he's supposed to block every single time and communicate the proper way, then he's got a great shot of being out there for us.
I had the honor and privilege of coaching against Dean Paul, who is the head coach at Ohio Northern University. He explains how he organizes special teams practices throughout the week.
I think what we'll do is we kind of have a blueprint with, you know, field goals, you know, certain day, like Tuesdays, for example. We'll get out there and, you know, Tuesdays will be a punt, and we're going to work on, I think, punt return and field goal on a Tuesday. And Wednesday, we're going to work punt basically every day. Mm-hmm. You know, then we'll work punt and field goal most days, even if it's a short time. One of the things we'll do different with practice organization, though, is we may have multiple units going at the same time. So on a Tuesday, we'll look at our depth charts and we'll try to see where we don't have crossover. I think typically for us this past year, we'd have punt return going at the same time as field goal. So that was pretty helpful. But, you know, Wednesday, we would then get, you know, as I said, get punt, field goal. You know, we'll get our kickoff, you know, kick return on those days as well. But we won't really work anything else. And then Thursday we'll work, you know, Thursday and Friday we're basically working different components of all six units. Sunday night, we have Monday as our off day, but Sunday night we'll do like a kind of a review of what's the unit that needs the most attention. And then we'll also work, you know, probably the thing we'll do a little different is we'll try to work some, not just scheme work, but some concept and technique work. So maybe we're working on our hold up on our punt return. Maybe we're doing a block circuit in week six. You know, we're doing technique work, not just scheme work. I think it's maybe something that we would do a little different than some, even late in the year.
Robbie Disher is the special teams coordinator at the University of Toledo. He shares why punt teams are putting more guys out wide and how it affects the return game, as well as why it plays directly into his strategy of bringing a rush and trying to block a punt. Let's listen to what he has to say.
To me, the hardest thing to do on to get a return started is block a flyer. Most teams call them gunners. We call them flyers. You know, the guys are moved. That's the hardest thing to do is win a single out there in space. So take a base formation. You got two of those. So you put two of your best guys in space that can do it, and maybe you have a guy that can double, kind of be off the ball and maybe double somebody if they get free. But a lot of these teams on the punt team are splitting so many guys out. You got like three or four or five of those guys, you're not going to get a return. Like, somebody's going to lose in space. Like, like we say, those are the hardest blocks. And if teams are putting all those guys out there, they're trying to make you fair catch or make you let the ball bounce. And, you know, and you're playing into their hands if you just go match everybody and be safe and have all these guys off the ball. And a lot of the mentality of these guys, a lot of the mentality is we just want the ball back. Don't screw it up. And I think you're playing into their hands if you do that. You got to be able to defend fakes and all that stuff. But how many fakes are teams running a year? Really aggressive teams, three, maybe. Most teams, one or zero. So it's like, don't worry about the worst thing that could possibly happen. Like, go make something happen. And if teams are splitting out all those guys, like, you don't really have a chance if you're playing safe. You're not giving your guys the best chance to be successful. And those guys are doing it because they're scared of the rush. So, yeah, you got to match the eligibles, and you gotta be sound against it. But we're not going to sit here and spend 10 minutes of practice time defending all these fakes that they may or may not run. Like, we're going to be aggressive, and we're going to play our hand of football to the best of our ability. And I think against teams like that, you got to bring pressure. And either if they don't bring guys in, you got a great shot to get there. And if they do, now you're making them play left-handed. You know, they're used to splitting all these guys out and doing all this stuff, and now you're making them emphasize protection, and maybe you got a couple matchups out there you can win, and now you got a better – you're giving yourself a better shot to get some returns. And, you know, to me, you got to be multiple in what you do on the return team. You got to – I believe you have to bring it once every game just to keep them honest, because so many people, like you said, are splitting guys out, you know, doing a million formations, and they're doing that to try to make you be base and just not rush the punt.
Taylor Melhaff is a former kicker and the specialist coach for the Wisconsin Badgers. He discusses with us some drills for helping place kickers and what coach thinks are the most important aspects of kicking. Let's listen to what he has to say about a kicker's practice routine.
I think from a drill standpoint for me, like I kind of hit on a little bit ago, but you can get so much better without even going out and hitting a ball. And a lot of the drill work that I have guys do is it's really more the muscle memory aspect of things. And so when you start talking about for kickers, for instance, your steps, that's really your foundation of everything you do. And I should really probably backtrack for a second here. As far as kicking goes, like there's no right way to kick. There's no, just because so-and-so in the NFL kicks like this, or just because whoever, every kicker is a little bit different, is unique in their own way. There's no right way to do things, but there's basic principles, basic fundamentals that everybody can use to really hit the ball higher, longer, straighter, more consistently. And so how do we get to a point where we can replicate that stuff over and over and over again? And for me, like I see some of these high school kickers now and I'm like, holy cow, I wasn't doing that at that age. I mean, some of these kids are getting so talented at a young age. I was more of just an athlete that worked really hard at it. That's how I became a good kicker. And for me, when our other specialists towards the end of practice, when those guys were over there talking about what they did last night or whatever, I was just down in the corner repping my steps over and over and over again. And I'd put myself, talk about that mental side of the game. The one thing that comes up over and over again when you're doing research is visualization, right? And so I would just sit there and I would work on my steps, and I would, you know, I'd visualize myself in the left hash, and I'd visualize myself in the right hash. And I would just go around, move around the field when when they were doing teamwork on one end of the field, I'd jump down the uprights on the other end. And then I'd go through my kickoff steps, you know, kind of like my menu of the coach said, hey, I want you to go left to left here. If I want you to go left to right here, if I want a mortar kick here, that just kind of I'd work my full menu of steps. And to me, that was a lot of my drill work, because if your steps are perfect, then you've got a chance every time. It's no different than a long jumper going through and making sure he's taken all of the board on every single long jumper or high jump, whatever, pole vault or whatever it may be. Your steps are your foundation of everything you do. And so that's from a drill standpoint. When I warmed up to kick, what I would do is I'd go through those steps and I'd make sure I'm hitting the exact same spot every single time. And like you said, it's hard to kind of talk through some of this stuff without showing video or showing it in person. Finding muscle memory drills where you're practicing things the right way. I see so many guys, for instance, now when we're getting ready for a game, and I'll watch other kickers from other teams. And I mean, obviously we're playing, this is Division I football, and I kind of get a kick out of watching some of the things that these guys do. For instance, a lot of kickers will do one step drills where it's a good drill to just kind of get your leg going and you're focusing on just making contact with the ball. But when you're kicking off the ground, like you have to in college and you have to in the NFL, you have a nice a deep plant foot, meaning your heel is about even with the ball. So it's kind of like hitting a wedge shot in golf. You're coming down on top of the ball. That's what's making it jump up. As opposed to in high school, you can use that block and the ball's sitting up. And so when you're kicking that way, you're actually hitting the ball on an upswing, much like you're teeing the ball up with the driver. And so I'll see when you're kicking the ball off a block, especially like some of these guys use a 2-inch block, your toe is even with the ball. So there's a huge difference there. And so I'll see guys work on these no steps, just making contact with the ball. And they're standing there with their toe even with the ball. And it's making them a worse kicker, because that's not how you kick. And they're kicking off the ground. They need to be having a nice deep plant foot that they're allowing themselves just to make contact. So essentially they're drilling into their muscle memory something that they're not even going to do during a game. And so I always see stuff like that. And so I think from a fundamental standpoint, as a kicker, you've got your steps that are your foundation. And as a kicker, you want to do the same thing the same way every single time. Meaning if I take my steps, if I walk my steps straight back and take a 90-degree angle over, if I hit that ball 58 yards, I want to hit it 58 yards every single time. Doesn't matter if it's an extra point. Doesn't matter if it's a 52-yard field goal. I want to hit that exact same ball. And I think back to when I was in high school, I would kind of just chip through the extra points. And then on 50-plus-yard field goals, I was swinging as hard as I could, you know, and that's just a recipe for inconsistency. And so, you know, I think for high school coaches in particular, you always want to get these guys to control what they can control, right? And one of the things that you can control are your steps. And so there are no right steps either. You see a lot of guys take 3 steps back and 2 steps over. That doesn't mean that's the end all be all. I think the most important thing is that you're comfortable in your approach. Got to be somewhat close to the ball, because we have to obviously have a good get off time, but you have to be comfortable there where what's going to put you in position to have the most success. And so those steps are really your foundation. I'll teach these guys, always walk your steps straight back towards your target, and then we'll always take them over at a 90-degree angle. And the reason for that is in high school, those hashes are so wide. And even in college, in the NFL, you're obviously those hashes are right along the upright. But in high school, with those wide hashes and on big angle kicks, if you aren't taking those steps at a 90-degree angle, it's going to catch up with you. And when your foundation is off, everything can be off. And it's as little as, say this, like if you walk your steps straight back and 90-degree angle over, let's say you are 100 inches from the tip of your toe to the ball. If you are off by even, you know, let's say you take an 85-degree angle or a 95-degree angle, you know, now all of a sudden you're 106 inches from the ball, or you're 94 inches from the ball. Like that's enough for you to, now you're reaching, or now you're kind of stuttering to get to the ball. And that's, you know, those are the things that you tell these kickers, man, in high school, you guys work so hard. You do so much throughout the off season. Don't miss a kick in a game because your steps are off. There's so many variables in high school that make kicking difficult, whether it's poor field conditions, not the best snapper, not the best holder, because you don't get to spend a ton of time with them. There's a lot of wind because you're in a big open field. There's all these variables that come into play, but always try to control the things that you can control, and that's your steps.
Sam Watts is a kicking expert, and he joined us on the podcast to talk about the specifics of the holder, exactly what a holder should do, the mechanics, what they're looking for, all the details that go into that important job on special teams. Let's take a listen.
The key thing I start with is that the holder needs to be the quarterback. The holder is the hardest job of that because the holder's sitting there, and when it's going to be snapped, what part does my body need to be where? So he needs to be in the perfect stance. The perfect stance would be right before he starts counting bodies, they find the mark of where the holder and the kicker are going to want the ball. It's not just the kicker's job. It's the holder and the kicker, because that way they make sure they're counting the exact yardage. Some snappers get their laces to be perfectly facing forward are 7.5 yards. Well, knowing that, I've watched kickers come out and they pick the spot. The holder's not paying attention, and they go at 6 yards. So say we're supposed to be at 7.5. The kicker and the holder find the 7.5-yard spot. The kicker starts to take his steps back. The holder gets into a stance, counts the 9 other guys, and then looks back in the proper stance. Again, the front knee is down, the back knee is up. So regardless if you're flipping for a left-footed or right-footed kicker, it's all the same. The front knee down at the holder, the back knee up. The holder has his hand on the ground or on the actual kicking block that's there, and it's his backhand. So his front hand is up towards the snapper, but his backhand is actually working on the block or the ground as a reference for the kicker to look at. So the reason why I say that the holder is the quarterback is because once everybody's in place and everybody's counted, the holder then either does his whatever it takes to make the snap come, whether it's a cadence or just a flick of the finger, that starts the progression of the operation. What should happen then is as soon as the ball is snapped, the backhand of the holder comes up as quick as he can. That triggers the kicker to start his footwork towards him. The tendency is sometimes coaches don't understand the actual stance of the holder, and they have the holder put his hands up in front automatically without waiting for the ball to be snapped, like they're actually going to try and catch it like a quarterback does in a pistol.
Right.
The negative of that is that you don't have any way for the kicker to know when to leave. If you watch the college guys at the high level and you watch all the NFL guys, 95% of those men kickers are looking at the backhand of the holder. The other 4 or 5% are actually looking at the snapper because they've learned how to time it up. But when we're talking with most men that are going to be listening, is that they're in that level of high school development. We want them to not try and follow a ball and then leave, because that means they leave late. So what happens when we leave late, then we rush our footwork. And I'll explain what I mean, leave late. If the ball is already in the holder's hands and the kicker starts to proceed his footwork, then it's too late. The reason why you want the kicker to watch the backhand coming up for the snap catch is that triggers him to start his footwork. So it's a nice, easy, relaxed step that he normally would take in practice or by himself off of a holder. So that you want the same rhythm every time. So when we leave when the hand comes up as a kicker, then we're on time, because then the ball is going to come in and the ball is going to go down. If we are waiting and we see the ball go down, instinctively our mind takes over and immediately we rush and we go faster, because we do have to get things done in a certain amount of time, which is what we call operation time. But if we do everything where the snapper watches the holder brings his hand up on time and the kicker leaves, that operation time in high school is like a 1.5 or under. Mm-hmm. A really good one in college is a 1.3 seconds or under, and in pros it's 1.25 or a little higher. But it's all, you know, depending on how accurate everybody gets and how much faster they get, the time does come down to comparing to the level that they go up. But it's all triggered mainly on the holder, and there's a lot of more work that could be put in the holder, but you never notice the holder until he drops one.
Patrick Manley is one of the best long snappers to play the game. The former Chicago Bear long snapper shares what he looks for in a long snapper, as well as his thoughts on a practice plan for the position.
The first thing I do, Charlie, with anything is I throw them a football and I say, just throw it to me, just to see if they can throw a spiral. Because it all starts with it's basically throwing a football between your legs, two hands. We'll talk about that later. But if I work with any kid that might be 7 years old to 27 years old, I just throw them the ball. I said, hey, man, throw me the ball, and I'll just play catch with them. And if they can throw a nice spiral, if their mom and dad taught them to throw a nice spiral, then you can long snap. You can work with that. You can mold that kid into learning how to then bending over and throwing that between his legs. But, Charlie, that's the first thing I do. If a kid can throw a good spiral, you can teach him the long snap. Yeah, that's something. As I got older, I did a lot less because I didn't want to break down, and I kind of felt like I had figured out what I needed to do. I think when you're younger, I think more can be better. I'll get to something else later about Mike Swetman that he taught me later, but about not doing too much. But I think more is better when you're younger. I think there is a point where you can like kind of wear yourself out. To me, my hamstrings always got real sore, and that might have gotten in the way. But I think once you figure out your routine of what you need to do, and then once you feel really comfortable about your work for the day, then it's time to shut it down. Some of the routine things I did is I would always start with my short snaps, get those down, get really comfortable with that, and then that would almost kind of be my warm-up routine because it is a shorter distance and you're not wearing yourself out trying to throw it 15 yards. But I would do – the thing is people ask me numbers, and I can't give you numbers. I never really charted how many I did. I just did it until I felt comfortable and confident that I had a great day of work. But I would make sure I knock those out first, and that would kind of be my warm-up routine. And then you would get into punt snaps, and I would do those again until I was comfortable or until I was tired. And then there would be some days that I felt like I was throwing the ball really, really well. I might do some extra just to kind of ingrain that good feeling in my mind. And then all of a sudden also be able to do it when you're tired. You know, most of the time as a snapper, you're only going to have one rep and you're going to run off the field. But there are times there might be a penalty. You got to run back and throw it back there again and make sure you're accurate. But, Charlie, I got to the point where I just felt really comfortable in the work I did that day, and I can't give you a number of reps. And that's been a hard question for me to answer for kids, but the more work is better. But there also is a point I want to go back to what I was telling you about Mike Swetman, that if you're having a bad day, just an off day, like a golfer on the range, a pitcher on the mound, and you're throwing the ball and it just feels awful, and there were a couple of days he looked at me, he's like, you're done. I'm like, excuse me? And this would be during the off season, but shut it down. I'm like, why? He goes, you're practicing bad habits. You're having a bad day. You're feeling it's off. I'm like, yeah. He goes, don't do it. Come back tomorrow and do a little extra. And that's something I took through the rest of my career, and it really helped because I'm a very competitive person. I enjoy work, and I enjoyed all that, the process of being a better snapper. And there would be days I would be in the Walter Payton Center, and maybe I was off, and I would keep grinding and keep grinding. I'm like, well, that makes sense to stop because I'm just practicing bad habits.
Ryan Partridge is the athletic director and head coach at Liberty High School in Brentwood, California. He led Liberty to the California 1A state championship in 2018. In this segment, he shares how the punt, block, and punt return techniques, which they call clasp, stick, scrape, J-angle, hit by, and engage, have become a big part of their culture because of the emphasis they've put on special teams.
So, I mean, this is a special team thing, and it goes further than just on the field because it's actually created a culture on our campus with the kids. And so it all starts on punt, block, and return. It's clasp, stick, scrape, J-angle, hit by, and engage. And so clasp is a technique where the front line on punt return is going to step on the punt team's toes and clasp their arms around their shoulder pads and grab on tight. And the second that, you know, the goal is to stand them still and gain a few seconds so we can create space for our returner. So the clasp technique, once that guy's out of your body, then it transitions to the stick technique. And the stick technique is an arm bar, run width, on top leverage block that you're running down the field with the guy. And so obviously you can't keep that stick for too long and the arm bar, you know, you might lose leverage. So if you slightly lose leverage, then you're going to start scraping. And scraping is basically running your hand from shoulder down to wrist over and over again. And we've actually gotten pancake blocks on this just because it's such a fast technique and guys are running down the field and they're scraping arms. And all of a sudden the punt team guy is just on the ground. And if you lose leverage and the guy gains space or he's faster than you, you're going to need the J angle. And that's just basically taking a big wide turn and trying to gain leverage back. And then this one, the next one, hit by is basically getting rid of the huge block. So when you J angle, you might have an ear hole big time block available. Well, now we're just hip buying, which is we turn our butt side right into the front of the defender or the side of the defender. We put our hands in the air and it's basically just like, we're not big blocking this guy. We're just hip buying him. And then the other one would be if you were still running with the guy and he breaks down to shimmy, then you engage on him. So our kids now will, you know, walk through campus and stick another kid, or, you know, they'll walk by me at lunch and I'm, you know, walking, talking to the principal or something, and boom, one of my D linemen hit by me. And it's become a pretty funny thing because it's such an early focus for us, because you can use all these things, not just on punt block and return, but, you know, receiver blocking and I really try to hit home the hit by, because I just hate to see these enormous hits and then I get a 15-yard penalty. So we try to hit home. We have a hit by drill, once a week usually, and it's pretty fun to see. You know, we saw Alabama posted on Twitter, a guy did a double hit by, and I didn't see it on Twitter, but one of my kids sends it to me and to a whole text thread of the whole team and goes, check out this double hit by. You know, it's like, that's awesome. You know, a technique on special teams that a high school kid's bought into. So it was pretty cool.
Bobby April is one of the best ever to coach special teams. The former NFL special teams coordinator shared his organization of game day operations in terms of special teams, where he likes to be positioned to watch the game, where he wants his assistants to be positioned, and which responsibilities every coach has. Let's listen to what Coach April has to say.
The first thing you have to do is realize that you, as the play caller, so to speak, you're generally looking out on the field at the situation, at the hash, at the down and distance, and at the opponent's sideline to make a strategic call. If you're that play caller for a return or where you want to punt the ball, whatever scheme you would be using, you almost have to be in that position to do that. So consequently, you're not turning around to the team to count everybody out. So you have to have someone who is responsible for helping you in that area. It unfortunately for myself, it's never been a great area for me. We've had our own gaffes on that type of thing, and it's a tough thing to get through. I think the biggest thing is to have a person that's very competent helping you, whether it's in the press box or on the field, and a head coach that puts a premium on the guys having responsibility for that area. And it's very tough, but one guy, it's very tough to do. When they start coming on and off after you've made that call, it can look like an intersection in Manhattan.
Absolutely.
And it's very, very tough to make that call. And by the time you realize it, it's usually a timeout or you're running somebody out there late, and if you even have that amount of time. So you got to have somebody with you. The players ultimately have to be responsible for it. The ultimate blame is going to go on the coach. So the old saying, if you feed the cats too well, they won't eat the rat. if they're too coddled, and it's always the coach's responsibility, sometimes they'll let you bear that. And that's a negative thing to say, but it's a truthful thing to say. So it's got to be instilled in them that this is their responsibility, just like being out there on first and 10 if you're starting corner.
Bobby, have you ever, and I've been, Dave used this, and I can't remember if we did it at the Bills or not. And I know we did it at Tennessee in 2012 when I was doing it. But have you ever incorporated the dots where the players, when you may have an assistant that's not as well versed, but they can at least make sure it all 11 dots or 7 of the 11 dots are filled if you got 4 out there on offense? Have you ever used that system?
You know what? I think it's a great system. I've never felt, at least in my situation, because I've seen it, it goes back a pretty good ways. I've never felt in the situation where I've been, and I've been with a lot of good teams, a lot of great coaches, that the culture was such that I was able to pull a kid from a positional discussion early enough to get him over there. yep. And, no complaints about it. I just didn't feel like that was ever our culture, where we had it that far in advance, we could get guys up and over to the dot. That's a different hill you have to take with an entire staff. One that I thought was not worth fighting for.
Just, it sounds like what you're saying, you're just adding one more element to it, the
that could go wrong? In other words,
well, you have to, you know, again, it's great. It's great, but the head coach has to make it great, because if you want those guys standing on that dot on third down and they just came off the field three plays ago from an 80-yard drive and that secondary right. coach is making an adjustment, you have to have the authority to say, the hell with the adjustment, I need the guy on the dot. And if you don't have that authority over the course of that many plays and that many situations, it's just, you know, it's just all being on the same page. It's just all being on the same page. And it always comes from the head coach. Now, the head coaches I've had were tremendous, I just, in my own mind, saw that and never felt comfortable to, you know, put that out to the team. I'd rather have taken the bullet the other way than the guys to take the bullet on maybe not having time to make an adjustment.
Gary Roberts is the winningest coach in Cottage Grove High School history. Cottage Grove High School is in Oregon, and he led the Alliance to the 4A state championship in 2018. In this segment, Coach Roberts explains how to teach the rugby punt and gives an explanation of the responsibilities for the unit.
Well, I work a lot with the punters on down and distance and understanding and trying to understand angles, you know, that, hey, you might look and see green, but you've got to cover 17 yards. He's got to cover 10 to catch you, you know, to angle you out of bounds. The first option on our punt scheme is actually the pass. We run kind of a wing trips look. The two outside receivers, they're the bullets for our punt team. So they sprint down. We use a tight end on the left side, so we're eligible. So we're good in terms of having enough guys in the line of scrimmage. And then our wing runs a speed out, and he's actually the first option. If nobody covers him, we dump it to the speed out. If he doesn't get the ball, he becomes the outside contain guy, which the tight end on the other side is our other outside contain guy. So the first option for the punter is to dump it off to the wing running the speed out. If somebody covers him on the speed out, then his option is either to run or to punt it. But we spend a lot down in distance and a lot of time on understanding situations. You know, if it's the fourth quarter, we're up, just punt the ball and play field position and things like that. So our punters have to be pretty savvy. And then there are times that I'll kind of look out to them and just kind of give the foot up, like just punt the ball. And they always kind of look over and get a glance at me and kind of understand what I'm hoping they'll do.
This last segment comes from me, and I did a podcast called Saving an Endangered Species, The Kickoff. And I really think that it's a beautiful play that should stay a part of our game. I also believe that there's some benefits in looking at how we teach the technique and revisiting our thoughts and philosophies on what that play should look like. Done right, I do think it is a safer play. I'll discuss the benefits of being able to set up a good kick return and the chances it gives you at scoring points. Additionally, I give the five main points that I use for kickoff return. So when I looked at the kick return, and I'll have a chart in our show notes with all the diagrams here. I will note that they are set up for the college level, so you do have to adjust them by 5 yards. But when you think of this, it's a big play potential. When we have the ball in our own territory or we have the ball on the plus side of the field, the way you're able to approach that as an offensive coordinator is much different. You're almost immediately into four down territory. And as you move down the field, your chances of scoring increase. So as a rule of thumb and some studies that have been done, this is included in the PowerPoint, which will be in show notes. You start inside your own 20, your chance of scoring on that particular drive is 15%. From the minus 20 to the minus 29, it's 25. Minus 30 to 39, 35. And essentially, it goes up all the way down the field. So as you hit the 50 to the 40 on the plus side, you're 65%, 10 more yards forward, 75%, 29 to 20, 85%. And inside the 20, of course, you're going to be 95% chance of scoring. So we wanted to increase our chances of scoring. We wanted to shift that momentum. When you think about it, this is something to establish momentum at the beginning of the game or a beginning of the half, or to regain momentum if the opponent has put points on the board. So that was our philosophy. That was our thought process behind it. So five things for us. We wanted to treat it as an offensive play to score. The second thing was that the success of it, we really believed, depended on timing and spacing. We must be disciplined and focused to do that. A lot was going to be put on technique. And the next thing is we really wanted to be aware of kick type and location. Those are things we would study up. And, you know, I had a lot of things to do as an offensive coordinator, but I was still going to spend part of my week studying this play, studying what our opponent did to cover kicks as well as their personnel in order to be able to decide which blocking scheme we were going to use. And our blocking schemes vary between a return right and a return left, a cutback right and a cutback left. That was it. So the decision was really easy. We usually would signal some of that depending on how the kicker would set up the ball if they were a team that liked to move it around. But we found quite a few teams who were going to line up and do the exact same thing every single time on kickoff. And I imagine that it's probably that way at the high school level. You're not going to see a lot of variation in what your opponent is doing. So this is a huge, huge opportunity to pick up a ton of yardage and shift the momentum of the game. Well, that was another fun set of podcasts to sift through and look for some great coaching points to share here on our Best Of series. We continue with our Best Of series here in the last week of December, and we'll come back January 6th with some new podcasts for 2020. Check out all we're doing on Twitter at FBDEV Coach. Follow me on Twitter at Coach K Grabowski, and check out our systems for blocking, tackling, and defeating blocks at footballdevelopment.com.